WBRU Growing, 1977 to 1987. In 1977, WBRU-FM was a thriving student commercial radio station with a firm grip on Providence's rock market. The station's eclectic progressive rock format included jazz after hours several nights a week, the 360-degree black experience and sound on Sunday afternoons, daily extensive news and public affairs programming, and a mix of freeform progressive rock programming. WBRU-AM continued broadcasting to the dorms, and a lot of people treated it as a training grounds for FM, while some others used it as a place for even further experimentation and more campus-oriented programming. Welcome to the Hotel California. 1977. Here's what was playing on WBRU.
John Peck, class of 64, lived in Providence and had a weekly show on WBRU-FM in the 70s and 80s.
When freeform radio was new, it was great, but there were inherent problems. You know, unless you had programmers who were extremely knowledgeable and extremely talented, it just didn't work.
It was a transition from the period of time when it was like a hippie freeform station where the, you know, DJs stayed up all night tripping.
Hunt Blair, class of 83.
And, you know, we'd climb up to the, like, to the roof. And I mean, it was just like an unbelievable scene. It was a little trail of, you know, the fabulous 60s just finally winding down.
In my first year there, there were no formats.
Jeff Lesser, class of 82. This recording's a little rough because he talked to us from Tel Aviv through the computer program Skype.
I mean, I remember we all thought we were really cool if we could figure out how to, you know, play, I don't know, AC/DC into Joni Mitchell or something like that.
I'm a radio, I'm a country station, I'm a little bit... During the summer of 1979, the WBRU FM and AM stations moved from the former studios in Fonts House overlooking the College Green to a brand new home at 88 Benevolent Street on the old Bryant campus. Amidst these years of the move, staff at WBRU-FM discovered that its Arbitron ratings, and consequently the core of its advertising revenues, had dropped sharply. John Peck saw it this way.
Part of the problem was that the later programmers suffered from the hip disease, which meant that if a record was being played by the commercial outlets, they would avoid it. So they, in many ways, they were stuck with somewhat inferior material as both the AM stations and the new FM stations, which were also sort of top 40, learned to come to grips with album acts.
Really, the year before I got to BRU, 80-81, was the time period when life turned upside down for WBRU.
David Malm, class of 86.
You know, BRU was the number one rock station. And, you know, as a result, it was sort of sitting very fat and happy. You know, there was really no format. People did what they want. And then in 81, life changed. All of a sudden, 94, Enjoy was 94 HJY, you know, Heart of Rock and Roll or Rock of Providence or whatnot, and basically obliterated BRU.
Jonathan Groff was in the class of 83, and he remembers this.
HJY went on the air and just blew it away. Then all of a sudden, you were not getting any national sales anymore, and just sort of panic set in. We couldn't make payments on, you know, the money that had been spent to move the station to 88 Benevolent Street and all these other things, and just operating costs of keeping the transmitter up, and there was a paid chief engineer, and the salespeople who were getting salaries, and it was really beginning to sort of hemorrhage money, and the ratings just, you know, weren't there anymore.
Faced with the prospect of financial ruin, the student station management looked towards a shift of the programming format in order to survive. Here's Jeff Lesser.
There was a lot of pressure about the format and, let's say, the professionalization of WBRU by the board of directors. As I recall, the board of directors is saying things like, the downsizing option is not permissible, because that was one possibility, was to kind of say, you know what? Instead of BRU proudly having $1 million a year budget and fighting these corporate behemoths for the audience, maybe BRU should be a kind of a college radio station, right? That was definitely one option on the table that was completely slapped away.
BRU went to the university and secured another loan. They convinced the university that by hiring a consultant and refocusing their format, they could become financially viable again. The consultant they hired was legendary radio man Lee Abrams.
I remember this incredible meeting with Lee Abrams in a hotel room in downtown Providence, in which, you know, he's sitting on a bed, like, eating pizza and talking all at the same time and kind of giving us the sell job. And, you know, he's got this huge, dripping pizza, and he's had this big beard, and pizza's in the beard, and it's spewing, and he's, you know, telling us all about the format and the brilliance of the format. It was really incredible. And I guess we eventually bought their package, or whatever the deal was, to become a modified AOR station.
David Malm.
They got themselves organized and hired Lee Abrams. You know, that was sort of like the Berlin Wall coming down or going up. Because all of a sudden, it was clear that BRU had to compete in a commercial marketplace. And life was never the same. And all of a sudden, you know, you couldn't play what you wanted. And they also, I guess, made the program director into a professional position. And, you know, there was a huge debate within the station. It was a bit of a civil war, frankly, within the station, in that there was one camp which was composed of sort of the programming department, the music people, and the business department. And then the other side of the station was the news department, which was huge, and some of the other formats, Jazz After Hours. It was this battle between them because they had been shunted aside. You know, the alternative formats were just pissed off.
Following the summer of 1982, Lee Abrams' new format was implemented at WBRU-FM, and the station slowly got back on its feet.
You know, we came back in the ratings and kind of solidified ourselves as the other rock and roll station in town that wasn't WHJY. You know, there were people who were completely demoralized with BRU moving to the format. And there were a whole group of other people in Providence for whom, you know, thought BRU was an elitist, snob, weirdo college kids who then started listening to BRU.
Overwhelmingly, listeners responded positively. WBRU-FM rapidly climbed in its ratings and revenue. Longtime listener Tom Carrazzo started listening in the early 80s.
We were the skateboard rats. We'd come to Thayer Street. You know, we were into surfing down in Narragansett, and we'd always go down to the shows downtown and, you know, see bands like, you know, the Ramones and, you know, Talking Heads, stuff like that. And really at the time, BRU was one of the only stations playing a lot of that stuff. And then we'd get, you know, we started to get turned on to other bands such as, you know, Susie and the Banshees, bands like that, you know, nobody else was playing until much later in the 80s. And really for me, it was an outlet to find new music, new bands, you know, and things that other kids weren't listening to.
Hello, this is Elvis Costello, and you're listening to 95.5 WBRU.
Hi, Susan, don't forget to mail me the check for $1 million for doing this ID.
It's Fred of the B-52s, and I'm on 95.5 WBRU, Providence, Rhode Island.
There were definitely, absolutely people at the station who were unhappy about it and quit and who were just like, you're a sellout.
John Groff, class of 83.
You're ruining this place. You're the problem. And then there were people who sort of sensed the excitement of this is a commercial enterprise, essentially, and let's embrace that and make it a different kind of educational workshop.
I was chilling in the shine and the light, not dial doing anything my radio advised.
The new format involved student programmers selecting from groups of pre-designated songs in categories and then playing those categories in a certain order.
There was a box of cards, essentially, and the cards were, there was probably about 1,200 songs.
Neil Bernstein, class of 88.
And every song fell into a category. And then you had what was called the clock, which was, you know, from the course of an hour, you're going to play this song from this category, and then that song, you know, and then a song from that category, and then a song back from this category. And it was arranged so that the newest music was always right next to the commercial break, so you could sell it. It was a fill-in-the-blanks kind of process. But you kind of had to, you know, you kind of had to pretty much play what was in the front of the category. So songs would come up, and you'd work them in, essentially. So you didn't have complete control, but you had, you know, you had pretty large control. You know, it was frowned upon if there was, like, a band that you just refused to play.
There were problems with the format at first that required, you know, tinkering and micromanagement. I mean, I remember, for example, it seemed at the very first, it seemed like every time you turn the radio on, it would be Creedence Clearwater.
Meanwhile, WBRU AM also moved its offices and studios to the top floor of the new 88 Benevolent Street studios. Unfortunately, by the early 80s, AM was also struggling with its own issues of survival. WBRU AM was still broadcasting on a closed carrier current signal limited to the Brown University campus. Craig Healy was the professional engineer for WBRU for more than 20 years, starting in 1980.
As the years went on, the noise level just increased to the point where we, in one case, put 20 times the power into a building that they started with, and you still couldn't hear it. Even with a good radio, you couldn't hear it. It got to the point where within the building it was inaudible, but two or three blocks down the road with a car radio, you could pick it up, which was illegal, so we wound it back down again. That's one of the reasons the demise of the AM is. The concrete and steel buildings attenuated the signal, and the inside noise level just blocked it out. That's why it just didn't work.
Sam Zwetchkenbaum, a programmer in the early 80s on both AM and FM, says that students on WBRU AM had come to expect poor reception.
It was so hard to listen to. I don't think it didn't have the level of quality that you'd think, oh, I'm going to just turn it on and listen while I study, because quality was so poor that it would be kind of distracting.
Nonetheless, AM still played a role on campus, not only as a training ground for future programmers on WBRU-FM, but also as an outlet for more experimental, local, and Brown community-based programming. There were shows like The Brain Bowl, a quiz show for Brown students, the Brown Community Forum, an open forum for the expression and questioning of local officials, and the Jocks Rap, live commentary of Brown athletics and other sports. Legendary ESPN sportscaster Chris Berman got his start on WBRU AM during the 70s.
Sam Zwetchkenbaum.
It was a training ground for people going on FM, and what I tried to do with some other folks is develop some interesting shows, because I think the typical college radio stuff was sort of lost when the FM station was trying to make money. They were really focused on, they wanted to sort of hide the college nature of it. So a lot of opportunities were missed. I guess I just felt that here was an opportunity to do something creative. If people were listening, great. If people weren't listening, at least it was a good experience.
Jeff Lesser.
The thing that I remember about BRU AM is not as a training ground for BRU FM, but really as where the real alternative stuff was going on, some of the people from BRUAM, you know, in a punk rock attack on disco, they turned their speakers into the quad and put on the song from Saturday Night Fever called Disco Inferno and burned disco records and, like, danced wildly around it.
Despite the new album-oriented rock format, student programmers on WBRU-FM still had some freedom to experiment with the production of specialty programming, such as Jazz After Hours, 360, and the news and public affairs programming. Here is Beth Marks-Lorge.
The programming, like the Jazz After Hours, 360 Degrees, and news, definitely made for the image of BRU. I think they became recognizable pieces of BRU. So things that listeners would tune in for. So I think they were a great way to build a brand. These were the components of it. These are part of what made us on the cutting edge of rock and roll or progressive at the time.
The music of Alexander Scriabin, two poems, Opus 69 from 1912 and 1913, performed by request. My name is Russell. Enjoy doing the Sunday Morning Classic show this morning. Stay tuned for the News Project here on 95.5 WBRU Providence, leaving you once again with our Sunday Morning Classics theme, Ben Webster with Sunday.
The 360 degree black experience in sound on Sundays was still extremely popular and successful, although some saw it as a relatively separate part of the station. Stephen Hill worked on 360 and graduated in 1984. He's now Vice President of Music and Entertainment Programming at BET Television.
It was completely autonomous. Like, there was no, it wasn't a bad thing, it just wasn't. There was rock during the week and 360 on the weekend. But it was always the single highest rated program, you know, ever. it was crazy the ratings it would get. It was really focused on the black community around Providence, not necessarily students.
The WBRU News and Public Affairs departments of the 1980s turned out a cast of notable and important news figures, such as John Klein of CNN, Allison Stewart of MSNBC, and Christiane Amanpour of CNN, among others.
One must recognize that Andropov is probably the most skillful Soviet leader on international politics since Lenin himself.
The United States and the Soviet Union prepare to resume arms talks in Geneva. Good morning, I'm Steve Abrams.
And I'm Audrey Stone. We'll examine the prospects for successful arms negotiations and offer the views of former Secretary of Defense James Schlesinger.
Also on today's show, we'll take a journey to the exotic and faraway places, courtesy of Overseas Adventure Travel.
By 1987, the formerly all-student run WBRU-FM had a paid professional sales staff, a receptionist, and chief engineer, in addition to a programming director who was usually a recent student, hired for a one-year term following graduation. Angus Rocket was one of the last unpaid chief engineers of the station.
We didn't have any choice. No. I have no idea why we wouldn't have been able to find somebody. It may have been out of fashion or something.
Although WBRU had student engineers for its entire history, Craig Healy was hired in 1980. And then he worked for BRU for 23 years. Here's Jeff Lesser.
The board of directors was particularly content with the increasing professionalization of BRU via a paid staff. Now, again, I don't want to say they were wrong in these decisions. I don't know. But they were definitely decisions that changed the dominant character of BRU. I don't want to make it sound like that the new dominant character wasn't one that was embraced by students. There were lots of students who were thrilled at the changes at BRU. As time went on, BRU became much more of a professional youth entertainment training ground. Then it was an artistic place to represent youth culture.
Allison Stewart was in the class of 1988. She worked at WBRU all 4 years she was at Brown, before later moving to an on-air job at MTV.
I really liked working with the professionals. Maybe this just means I'm a sellout at an early age. I saw it as this incredible opportunity to learn what the real world was like with this safety net of the university and the school. So I was proud that we were a professional radio station. I thought that was different. And I can remember going home my first break and just wanted to keep being on the radio. And I worked at a pure college radio station. And, you know, to me, it seemed a little bit navel-gazing. So I thought, this is so junior league compared to what we do.
But students' faith and listeners' interest in the 1982 programming format was slowly waning by 1986 and 87. Change was imminent. Doug Mayer, class of 87, recalls the lead-up to the cutting-edge of rock format.
We were playing the Superstars 2 format, which had a bunch of cool music, but it was also playing, like, you know, funky retro stuff from the 60s, which I always liked, but, you know, increasingly we were kind of out of touch with the students. And so I think the change, you know, after my era made, you know, perfect sense in terms of finding something that, you know, the students wanted to play.
Neil Bernstein was in the class of 88.
The ratings weren't great. WHJY was still the big station and kind of kicking our butt on the rock and roll side. Mm-hmm. We had kind of made an attempt to cater a little bit more to their audience, and we started playing some bands like Journey and some of these other sort of, what we called at the time was corporate rock, bands that weren't really true to the format. And I think it hurt us. It was not a big consensus, and it was not a big crisis. I don't remember any time where we all kind of sat down and said, gosh, we better do something or we're going to go under. You know, it wasn't one of those things.
And so by 1987, plans for developing a new image and format had begun. It was called the cutting edge of rock.
But one of the first things, and this is like the exam I remember the promotions director gave before I got there, and one of the questions was image beats blank, and the answer was substance.
Beth Marks-Lorge.
And that was like my first lesson in marketing ever. I mean, the person has a sense of humor who did that, but really the goal of the promotions director was to make sure that the image of the station was correct, whether that's getting feedback from listeners and understanding what our image is to them and making sure that our image is getting communicated through our various promotions and advertising. We would write out the positioning, what our image was supposed to be, and the cutting edge of rock and roll, I think it's actually different ways to say a similar thing. BRU has always been on the edge and always, you know, trying to get the new music out. It just became more formal with that concept.
In retrospect, students who worked at BRU from 1977 through 88 had a pretty wide range of reactions to the changes the station went through. Here's Mary Julian, class of 82.
This was our baby, and we all felt that we were doing a good job. We felt we were delivering good programming, and all of a sudden, it was being taken away from us for money, for purposes of bringing in, you know, enough advertising, and when you're a student, you don't really see that connection yet.
Jeff Lesser.
It was a wonderful place to learn about responsibility and leadership, to do these things that they're affiliated with Brown, but it's not like there was a professor there holding our hands. I mean, we did it, for better or for worse, but it was us.
Beth Marks-Lorge again.
I always loved music. That's why I went to BRU. And BRU just... it was a place for me to continue to enjoy music, and it gave me the confidence to do whatever I want in life. Every time I hear BRU, it's a warm feeling. So it's a great experience, I think, for anyone to have at school, and it's just so nice to have it continue to be part of the people who have been there.